who run the economy, whether it's food or water or seed or fuel. Who's providing it in third world situations? It's the women. But that's the economy that's not noticed, that's not registered. I had a debate with McKinsey, the big consultancy firm. They put out a huge report for India, and the first line was, India only processes 1% of its food. And I asked them about, I mean, are we eating the rest of the 99% raw? And they said, no, only 1% is processed at the industrial level. Well, 1% was processed at the industrial level because we had a very sane, sensible policy which realized that food processing was best done at the local level. That's where safety was guaranteed. That's where livelihoods were guaranteed. So if you see up, you know, these lovely papars you eat in Indian restaurants, you couldn't make papars in the industrial sector. You couldn't make pickles in the industrial sector. Now Nestle sells us Mother's Pickle. I was reading on my flight over that Lever's is going to package under its trade name Nor some fish paste that the Vietnamese make. The entire food processing issue is such a clear example of total negation of women's creativity, work, and knowledge. It leaves the women who are robbed of their livelihoods when that moves, that production. If, for example, milk production, the biggest milk economy of the world is India. 100% of the milk production in India is in the hands of women. None of it is in a factory condition. A woman will have one buffalo, one goat, one cow, and that's the base of this giant-sized dairy industry, which now the global industry has set its eyes on and would like to be able to take over. The women lose their jobs. Unhealthy products start getting substituted. And you have all the results to see. In England, there was the mad cow. Totally a result of moving food and feed out of local domains. Nobody knows what they're feeding these cows anymore. And it's ground up, diseased, infected cattle. And they had this word for it called rendering. And I'm always very suspicious when they have an incomplete phrase, you know, rendering what into what, then I'd know. You know? But they just say rendering. It's just like economies in transition. Transition from where to where? But these sort of hanging verbs, you know, have become so convenient to describe processes which no one ever really figures out. They just assume, you know, it's from something bad to something good, not the other way around. But if you've heard Gorbachev, whose economy is supposed to be in transition, he said when we got rid of communism, we thought we would have democracy. But instead, what we have is mafia rule. So that word of economies in transition never said economies in transition to mafia rule, because people would have made other decisions if they'd known. In a way, it's similar doublespeak being used to take away the last resources on which people who are called poor depend for a life of dignity and a life of security. And these last set of resources are water, biodiversity, and food. I have done, most of my last 15, 16 years have been spent on trying to defend both the biodiversity itself, the rights people to have access to it, and resisting the monopolies over biodiversity through the twin mechanisms of patenting and intellectual property, which would make seeds, genes, animals, plants, the exclusive monopoly of corporations. And when we are talking exclusive monopoly, let's not forget that today 93% of all genetically modified seed planted anywhere in the world is Monsanto seed. One company. It could be cotton, it could be corn, it could be potato, it's Monsanto. So we are talking about monopolies of the scale we have never known. The interesting thing is these monopolies are being introduced in yet another element of doublespeak, which is called competition. Yeah? So if In India, 750 million farmers are saving their seed and have total freedom to save, exchange, improve their seed, create wonderful varieties like Basmati. That is not competition. That is a monopoly. 750 million free farmers are a monopoly. One Monsanto entering the scene is competition. As a result of those changes, Monsanto has come into India, bought up every private seed company, and then pushed the policy system exactly like your system has been pushed to cut down on welfare. There is this artificially created social poverty, public poverty, that takes finances away from public expenditure. Our public seed banks have closed, so Monsanto comes in with these wonderful ads, and all our gods are used as salesmen. And depending on the region, the advertising companies, I must say, are very, very smart. They do homework. So they know that in the east, it's Jagannathan, Lord Jagannath. In north, it's Punjab, it's Guru Nanak. And you go south, it works to have Hanuman do your marketing for you. As a result of this, let me just run through a few figures for you. As a result of these seed monopolies, increased expenditures on seed, increased locking in of seeds with chemicals and more expenditure on that, the debts that farmers have accrued are so high they can't pay them back. 25,000 farmers have committed suicide, a phenomenon not known in India before. Farmers are selling kidneys to pay back debt. Of course, they're having to sell their land and their cows and the buffaloes. And when they get too desperate, they drink the same pesticides. Drinking pesticide is the most frequent method for committing suicide in farm deaths. And then these miracle seeds that gods are selling are not performing the miracles they were supposed to. So the farmers of South India have lost last year 1 billion rupees worth of a crop in cotton. And in North India, Monsanto sold hybrid corn because they're not allowed to sell genetically engineered corn yet. They haven't got a permission. But the hybrid corn failed totally in the entire North Indian belt, leaving farmers with losses of $4.6 billion. So just in two seeds in 1 year, added to this is the fact that the whole globalized trade system is nothing but taking away the incomes of the poor. It could be incomes of the poor working in agriculture in the third world. It could be incomes of the poor working in any sector anywhere in the world. But the entire globalized trade system and the so-called free trade system, I see it as nothing but freedom to rip off the worker. And in the case of agriculture, you must have heard the Cancun failure, the big debates around that, the committing of the farmer Lee, the Korean farmer committing suicide, carrying a banner saying WTO kills farmers. And it's no more metaphorical. It's no more dramatic. It is real. Our figures show, and we've done very detailed study in sector by sector about what these liberalized trade rules do in terms of depressing prices and what those levels of increased poverty, of real poverty now, imply. It's about 50% to 70% of rural incomes have been robbed in the last few years. For India, our figures are $26 billion per annum. $26 billion per annum in terms of lost incomes, real poverty. And you just have to look at the case of coffee. More and more trade in coffee, more and more consumption of coffee. The trade has doubled from 40 to 70 billion. And while the trade has doubled, the incomes of producers have dropped from 9 to 5 billion. And in Nicaragua and Colombia, the farmers who were growing coffee are starving. They're destitute. Every few weeks, there's some report on coffee growers not being able to survive, not being able to live. That's a real poverty. So if every fourth farmer is an Indian farmer, and Indian farmers are losing $25 to $26 billion a year across all farming communities, farmers are losing $1 trillion a year. That's losses in agricultural incomes. Move to the patenting issue. The fact that crops, seeds, knowledge we have evolved, the neem, the basmati, now the wheat. As these plants and seeds are patented, as seed becomes a marketable commodity owned as private property through intellectual property rights, the figures are industry figures. They talk about a $1 trillion market through intellectual property rights and plant genetic resources. Now, a $1 trillion market for Monsanto means $1 trillion poverty for the farmers who now pay for what belonged to them, their own seed. That commodification is a new poverty. Water privatization, again a figure generated by the water companies themselves. There are 5 water companies. Well, actually, there are 5 everything. It's a magical number. There are 5 grain trading companies, Cargill, Conagra, ADM, Bunge. You know those names. They are everyday names for you. They are strangers for us. We're getting to know them now. But for you, they've been around for a long time. Biotechnology, there used to be 5, but in a way, the others are waiting in the wings while Monsanto does the dirty work for everyone. And then they'll come out. Then the Syngentas and all will come out. Meantime, it's only Monsanto. But the concentration is huge. There used to be Sandoz, Ciba-Geigy, Astra, Zeneca, 4 different giants. All chemical giants, pharmaceutical industry, agrochemicals. They bought up the seed companies. They bought up the biotech companies. 5 giants now control all health, all medicine, all seed, all agrochemical. So all our entire food and healthcare in the hands of 5 giants, who then want the right to sell medicines that can be sold for $100, $200 at $20,000, $30,000. That's the debate in WTO on AIDS. That's the debate in your Medicare and the old people not being able to afford drugs. It's the same debate everywhere. Now, for the old person in this country not having access to medicine is poverty, just as for that patient of AIDS dying in Africa for being forced into a denial for something that should be accessible is also a vicious creation of poverty. The 5 giants in water are Suez, Vivendi, Bechtel, RWE, Thames. Enron, Monsanto tried to be there. Enron, you know where it went. Monsanto, I guess, is just holding out to see if it survives seed, then it'll get into water. But this seed industry, in World Bank analysis, through World Bank analysis, has said, if water is privatized, commodified, the water market, which means for every drop of water we drink, and, you know, Coca-Cola has a slogan, it's, you know, at its board meetings of 2-3 years ago, they said, every day, how many billion of us there are, goes thirsty a number of times a day. Our objective has to be that at no point can any human being quench their thirst without Coca-Cola. Now, that $1 trillion market that's being seen in terms of privatized water, whether it's privatization through bottling or privatization through municipal supplies, etc., all of that means people pay more. I'll just give you 2 quick stories. In India, Coca-Cola is, of course, setting... I know they were thrown out in 1977 for fudging with their taxes, etc. But they came back under globalization. And now they are mining water wherever they can set up. And down south in Kerala, women are fighting. 1.5 million liters of water being mined daily has left a 10-mile radius totally without water. And water privatization is not just a problem in rural communities like the community in Kerala in Plachimada. I remember in the water privatization campaign, I think it's one of the northern cities, I think it's Detroit, where water was privatized. The women who had been put off welfare couldn't pay. 50,000 disconnections, lines were disconnected, no access to water. In rich, powerful America, the poor have no access to water under privatization. So if you add the three sectors that are absolutely vital to living, you've got $3 trillion of new poverty. But this new poverty is a different kind of poverty because it's not just leaving you with less, with which people have learned to cope amazingly. It is leaving you with nothing. It's leaving you with no means to live. And that is why I say what used to be the polarity and inequality of the haves and have-nots has been mutated into a new polarity of the live and live-nots. And inequality now is written in terms of some people having no right to live on this planet. I believe that's unacceptable. I believe everyone born has equal rights to live. It doesn't matter what their gender, doesn't matter what their race, doesn't matter what their religion, doesn't matter where they were born. The planet, as Gandhi said, gives enough for everyone to meet their needs. And if today the right to life is being taken away, it's not being taken away because there aren't enough resources in the world. It's being taken away because of a greedy economic system based on organized greed as the only principle there is. There's nothing else, which is treating everything as a commodity, is everything being for sale, but when everything is for sale, life becomes too expensive. You can't buy life. You can live life. You can't afford to buy every drop of water you drink, every morsel of food you eat, at a time when every livelihood option is also being shut out, so that your entitlements are not being worked out also through incomes. And that is why in response to this world order, which is a world order of creating real poverty by taking away the real wealth of people and leaving them with nothing, when the slogan of that world order is everything is for sale, the global movement, which has been resisting WTO and this commodification, basically says our world is not for sale. That's the theme around which we organize. And I try and articulate this both at the level of actions on the ground as well as ways of thinking of a period beyond globalization. And I like to think of it in terms of an earth democracy in which all of us are citizens along with other beings and other species. And our rights to live with dignity and love and compassion are rights given from nature and creation, not rights written by states or rights that can be extinguished and robbed by a handful of corporations. Thank you.
Bad children, they are our governments.
I think, you know, what's very often forgotten is WTO is nothing but our governments in membership in one multilateral body, which then gets used and misused in all kinds of ways. But the reason I am at these meetings is to remind our government about their duties under our democratic institutions and our constitution, in a way to be their conscience, partly also to be the source of information. The reason, if you look at the history of WTO, there was no agreement in the Uruguay round. And then the Europeans and US got together and hustled an agreement. It was called the Dunkel draft text, which we used to call DDT in India. And then we got the WTO, in a way without agreement. And the WTO was used to bully everyone. In Seattle, the movements had become alive to the issue. But meantime, the excluded countries were also alive to the fact that they weren't even being brought in, because three countries get in and say, we'll agree to this, and then come out and say, we've agreed. And the Africans said, but what about us? We are not going to be rubber stamps. So the combination of the protests on the street as well as the protest by the marginalized countries, especially Africa and the Caribbean, the small countries who have no trade interest for anybody. They're too tiny. They have nothing to export, no buying power. You know, India's middle classes are so huge. And India, 750 million peasants are the biggest market for the Monsantos. So India is always taken into the discussion. Brazil is taken in, but the small countries were left out, and they said no. Doha, there would have been no agreement. Right till midnight, our minister was saying, sorry, we are not going to allow a larger WTO. And then in the middle of the night, he got a call, and from what we've heard, it was a call, Washington to Blair, Blair to our prime minister to our minister, to basically say, by your fighting in WTO, you are breaking the coalition against terror. And in a way, the Doha Development Round, as it's called, was basically a blackmail round, using the terror issue to force a fake agreement. That's what was supposed to have now been finalized in Cancun. But every year, the impact of these agreements shows up more. You know, more and more countries are losing out. And now they're not willing to go along, especially in a one-sided implementation where, you know, you have a farm bill that has increased the subsidies to agribusiness. Steel tariffs is a big, big hot issue already now. All of this is showing two things. One, that free trade is a one-way street. The South should do free trade and remove restrictions, and the North can go along as it is. The way I look at it, you know, at this point, the institution has lost credibility, but it's necessary to do two or three things that IMF and World Bank can't do. IMF and World Bank cannot impose intellectual property. They can use financial conditionalities, but they can't impose intellectual property. And the second thing IMF World Bank can't do is create this whole global corporate-controlled agriculture. Those, I believe, are the two areas where the WTO is absolutely necessary. And you'll notice, even the free trade of the Americas failed in getting these two areas in, because these are the two most controversial areas. And the way we are dealing with it now is at two levels. Continuing the movements, because our movements are movements of both building alternatives on the ground that make this whole system redundant to people's lives. Farmers saving seeds, setting up community seed banks, doing agriculture without their inputs, marketing locally so you're not locked into their falling prices. All of that is alternatives. And the second is resisting both locally, nationally, and globally. And in terms of the resistance, I hope I've carried this with me. We have two very creative international campaigns. One is in the GMO case of US against Europe. We are building up a citizens' challenge worldwide, including American citizens. The sign-on is at gmochallenge@yahoo.com. And the idea really is to begin an amicus saying, you call yourself a multilateral institution, Mr. WTO, but look how you're being used as a unilateral instrument of one company to force open markets and take away the democratic rights of people. We want this to be very big here in this country so that your rights to choose, which have never been discussed and debated, start becoming more active, that this case against Europe is not American citizens, against European citizens, and that your rights are violated just in the same way. But the second element of it is to really consolidate the 10 years of history of genetic engineering, including the fraud, including the deception, including the performance, etc., so that citizens actually have their own history. It's not available in one place. Africans have their experience, Indians have their experience, everyone has have fragmented experience. The second thing that I'm really excited about is doing a trade treaty, taking the earth, farmers, and food seriously. What would trade in agriculture look like if sustainability, food security, safety, farmers' livelihoods had to be taken into account? It's not too difficult to rewrite that agriculture agreement. But it will do two things. The movements building alternatives get strength, and the fraud of the WTO agreement starts to show. So one has to do whatever one can. There's no one miracle solution. The most important thing is the fact that there is no one way is precisely the reason that we are all free to create different ways that are appropriate to our conditions, our situations. And we have to engage because too much is at stake. Thank you. I just announced at the end, I'm going to leave our magazine, our journal, with the Humanities Center, because we, after 9/11 and other things, we've started a school for short courses for what I call Education for Earth Citizenship. And it's basically sort of very in-depth work with leading activist thinkers on these kinds of issues on our organic farm in Dehradun. So if any of you ever feel inclined traveling to India, you'll have the contacts right there at the center. And I'll also leave this our posters on what the Earth Democracy, Living Democracy movement, and how we organize and think about it in terms of defending people's rights.
Vandana Shiva, speaking in Claremont, California, earlier this month. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for this tape. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
Our genes, they would patent oxygen if they had the means. They'll patent their drugs. Some will get you high, and it's the best democracy money can buy. They're filling the prisons, their leanest industry, which lines their pockets. Helps us all be free, 'cause you gotta do something with the unemployed if they won't move to Shanghai. And it's the best democracy money can buy.
We'll conclude the program with the next installment of our ongoing reading from the book Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in 2000. Disciplined Minds looks at the political and ideological confines of professional work and professional training and its impact on society. We'll pick up where we left off last week in Chapter 7, which is titled Opportunity, which examines the American myth of opportunity and the reality. How much is there and who gets it? We'll continue our reading in Chapter 7 with the subsection titled A Life and Death Matter.
The stakes are high for anyone who asks, will I be able to go to school and become a professional? Riding on the answer to that simple yes or no question are the individual's education, occupation, and income, three of the four most common measures of social class. Social origin is the fourth. It is no wonder, then, that the issues of opportunity in a hierarchical society arouse as much emotion as do questions of war, capital punishment, and other life-or-death matters. Ironically, this strong reaction to issues of opportunity makes more sense than those who display it realize, because social class literally is a life-and-death issue. People experience big differences in rates of sickness and death according to the amount of education they have, the type of work they do, and the amount of money they make. These disparities between socioeconomic groups have been increasing, yet the public is only vaguely aware of them because the mass media rarely mentions them, and because until recently, academics have conducted almost no studies to document them. The sponsors of social science research evidently have not been interested in drawing attention to the lethal nature of the hierarchical social structure. However, actuaries and the insurance companies and pension plans that employ them have made it their business to know about such disparities. Earn More, Live Longer is the blunt title of an article written by a senior actuary at the U.S. Office of Personnel Management and published by the Society of Actuaries. The article, which professional schools could use as a recruiting tool, reports the results of a study that grouped over 1 million retired federal employees by their final salaries. The studies found that people who worked in the lower salary ranges, where non-professionals are most likely to be, are dying at a much faster rate than are people who worked in the upper salary ranges, where professionals would be. Consider, for example, the implications for 57-year-old males who are receiving annuities today. Those whose salaries were less than $30,000 in 1994 dollars are twice as likely to die within the next 12 months as are those who made $60,000 to $80,000. The people who have the best jobs enjoy lower death rates across a wide spectrum of diseases and other threats to life. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company documented this by releasing mortality statistics on male employees of two large companies. Employees with low-paying positions were over 30% more likely to die during any given year than were their better-paid co-workers. Those with the better jobs were less likely to suffer fatal cancer, diabetes, cerebrovascular disease, heart disease, influenza, pneumonia, accidents, or suicide, every cause of death studied. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, professionals are more likely to be in excellent health than are workers in any other major occupational group, whether white-collar workers or blue-collar. And they are only half as likely as other employees to be in fair or poor health. They experience fewer hospitalizations and shorter hospital stays than do their non-professional co-workers, such as clerical and other administrative support employees. The professional's higher income is not the underlying factor. The CDC found that even when professionals and non-professionals have the same incomes, professionals enjoy markedly better health. Thus, the individual who fails to become a professional, but nevertheless manages to achieve a professional-level income, will be significantly less well off. The stress caused by social hierarchy is what produces the excess sickness and death studies found. People in higher social classes experience less stress and therefore live healthier and longer lives, but so do people in less hierarchical environments. Thus, the less income inequality there is within a country, state, or community, the better the health and the greater the longevity of middle-income individuals. Of all the measures of social class, level of education turns out to be superior as a predictor of physical and psychological well-being. Of all the occupational groups, professionals have the highest level of education. So it would be hard to make the stakes in professional training any higher for the individual. And I'm reading from Discipline Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Continuing with the next section titled, Ugly Scene at the Narrow Gate. As workers have had less and less choice in how to get ahead, they have focused more and more attention on the question of who gets to take the key steps to advancement. Their sensitivity to this issue of opportunity is heightened further by their own personal histories, which often contains painful compromises, and by every reminder that some people do have creative and fulfilling working lives. Touchy topics include affirmative action in university admissions, in admissions to professional school, in hiring, or in promotions. A system that promises unlimited opportunity while actually rationing it, puts the worker in a sore spot, ready to strike out at anything that seems to limit the chance of escape. The disputes that have arisen within the resulting explosive climate are evidence of the gross mismatch between aspiration and the amount of opportunity available to fulfill it. Perhaps the most publicized example was a claim in 1974 that affirmative action programs discriminate against whites. In that year, Alan Bakke sued the University of California for admission to its Davis Medical School after he failed to secure one of the 100 annual openings there. At the time of the Bakke case, the UC Davis Medical School was rejecting about 2,000 applicants annually, the large majority of them white. The number has since risen above 4,000. The school had changed its admission system so that 16 of each year's 100 students would be admitted according to criteria that took into account certain background factors. In effect, this program admitted 16 students, almost always minorities, with lower grades and test scores than were otherwise required. Even though some minorities met and were admitted by the normal criteria, that is, as part of the 84, the use of changed criteria was the only way to get the desired minority student population. Because his grades and test scores were higher than those of the 16 minorities, Bakke claimed he was more qualified to become a doctor and should be admitted. The media play given this case was intense enough to legitimize and popularize a certain notion that was new to most Americans: reverse discrimination. Within the explosive climate described above, focusing national attention on a claim of reverse discrimination could send only one message to the opportunity-starved worker: the minorities are taking your opportunity, and that is one big reason you are still where you are. Such racism takes the anger that springs from the frustration of a life of limited opportunity and aims it at other victims, the minorities, thus taking the heat off the hierarchical system that by its very nature restricts the number of openings. And so we have ludicrous situations like the one at UC Davis, where almost 2,000 rejected whites could think of 16 minorities as stealing their opportunity to become doctors. Those suckered into the racist diversion reveal themselves in various ways as they try to cover their attacks on affirmative action by emphasizing how they are so very much in favor of equal opportunity, as they make little jokes about how, for a particular job opening, it would have been an advantage to be black or female, or a black female, ha ha ha, or, as they more openly cry, reverse discrimination. The worst thing about victim blaming is not that it does nothing to increase opportunity. The worst thing about victim blaming is not that it does nothing to increase opportunity, but that it works against such an increase. The pyramid-shaped socioeconomic hierarchy and the power elite at the top of it will be secure as long as those at the lower levels blame one another for their lack of access to jobs with greater decision-making power, and as long as they fail to question the system that makes the decision-making power scarce in the first place by holding so much of it at the top. When those who have failed to break out of unchallenging jobs do not blame minorities or women for their plight, they usually blame themselves. They become targets of their own anger to the extent to which they believe that the competition in which they are failing is both proper and fair. Self-blame is another form of victim blaming, and through it the hierarchical system that limits opportunity is once again spared criticism. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing with the next section, A Strategy for Understanding. While those who blame themselves for not getting ahead focus on their failure to meet the qualifying standards for training or advancement, those who blame minorities and women focus on the fact that those groups have not been held to the standards. Neither type of victim blamer dares to question the standards themselves, apparently without even thinking about it. they go along with the generally accepted belief that there is a universal notion of individual merit, one that is politically neutral and that can therefore be agreed upon, even by people who otherwise disagree in the most fundamental ways because of their conflicting interests. Upon such a notion of merit, one could base standards for qualifications that are fair and for the good of all sectors of society. Victim blamers believe such standards are possible, and they measure today's standards against a notion of merit that they think is above partisan politics. However, conflicts of interest within society, this is not a classless society after all, and conflicting visions of the way society should be lead to conflicting standards for qualification, and for professional qualification in particular. The first step in judging today's standards for professional qualification, then, must be to state a point of view, because no one can honestly claim to judge them on behalf of universal interests. Ironically, supposedly universal definitions of merit or excellence have historically represented the interests of only a small segment of the population. Working people, minorities, and women, who together make up the large majority of the population, have had a difficult time becoming professionals, except when they have been the children of professionals, or in times of economic expansion, the children of upper strata workers. I will evaluate today's standards for professional qualification from the point of view of this underrepresented majority. We can uncover what the criteria are all about by asking what they do for us as individuals and as a society. Do the qualification criteria give members of the underrepresented majority much opportunity to become professionals? Do the qualification criteria help produce professionals who will best serve society? A detailed look at particular examples will help us answer these questions for the qualification criteria of the professions in general. Because the peculiarities of medical training bring into public view some criteria for professional qualifications that are more hidden in other fields, I will continue in this chapter the discussion of medicine that I began with the Bakke case. To be certified as a professional in any field, you must demonstrate that you are qualified. You do this mainly by completing professional school. However, you are not allowed to enter professional school unless you already possess some of the qualifications that are in the end required for certification as a professional. Exactly what portion of the professional qualifications you must have to advance varies from profession to profession. In some professions, training programs give applicants relatively good odds of being admitted, but relatively poor odds of completing the training. Others are just the opposite. Medical schools, most notably, require extremely high grades and test scores, extensive interviews, recommendations, and other documentation just for the chance to try to learn medicine. But once a student is admitted to medical school, completion is almost assured. Astoundingly, more than 96% finish. By way of comparison, fewer than half of engineering school freshmen ever get their engineering degrees. The determination that one is qualified to become a medical doctor is made more before medical school than during or upon completion. The existence of an early and clearly defined point of decision on careers in medicine works to stimulate the controversy in medical school admissions. Unlike training programs that admit a group of students and then weed out individuals at points along the way, medical schools do the selection just once, in advance, so that whether they like it or not, the results are easy for all to see. This makes any inequality in the selection of doctors more obvious to the public than would be the case in professions with training programs that make greater use of weeding out as a method of selection, where the bias is more hidden in the day-to-day training process. Because medicine demands that the student fulfill so many of its expectations in advance just for admission to training, it is a field where an examination of the training school admissions criteria should reveal a lot about the nature of the criteria for professional qualification. With this in mind, let us use the two questions just posed to evaluate today's criteria for professional qualification in medicine, both the standard criteria and the special criteria used in affirmative action programs. I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. This is Chapter 7, Opportunity. Continuing with the next subsection titled, Benefit to Individuals. Do the qualification criteria give members of the underrepresented majority much opportunity to become professionals? The standard criteria for medical school admissions make fewer doctors of working class, minority, and women students than the proportions of these groups in the population would dictate. The standard criteria tend to fill medical school openings with students from middle-class families, often the children of doctors. By contrast, special admissions programs increase the opportunity of the underrepresented majority. Even those working-class whites who see opportunity as a zero-sum game and who do not understand the overriding importance of fighting racism should see that this is true and not a problem. In the affirmative action program at the UC Davis Medical School, for example, few of the 16 spots set aside would otherwise have gone to working-class whites. However, nationwide, there is only one opening per year in medical school for every 17,000 Americans, so the total amount of individual opportunity at stake in medical school admissions is relatively small. But there is more at stake here than opportunity. The existence of working-class, minority, and women doctors helps counter at least the forms of classism, racism, and sexism that questions the capabilities of members of these groups. Special admissions criteria, then, benefit not only the few working-class, minority, and female individuals that they make into doctors, but all members of the underrepresented majority, because the special criteria help counter ideologies that put down and divide the groups that make up this majority. The standard criteria benefits neither the individuals nor the groups. Benefit to society. Do the qualification criteria help produce professionals who will best serve society? This is by far the more important of the two questions. Most people are, with good reason, more concerned about the nature of medical care available to them than about whether they themselves can go to medical school. From the point of view of the working class, for example, the kind of medical care one doctor gives workers over the course of a career is far more important than the opportunity for one worker to become a doctor. Analogous statements are true for other professions. In general, we must judge criteria for professional qualifications most of all by their effect on the way the resulting professionals will function in society. If workers want the best possible doctors, best that is from a working class point of view, then charges that special admission programs lower the standards must be taken very seriously. Unfortunately, people who think of themselves as being on the political left generally do not face the question of standards squarely, and so they argue for affirmative action solely in terms of our first question, increasing opportunity for the underrepresented. Those on the political right who equate affirmative action and lowered standards know that our second question, producing professionals who best serve society, is indeed more important than our first, and so they have an advantage in the debate. However, when they use the term most qualified or best possible professional, they show their failure to understand that a professional is more than someone with technical knowledge. In the case of doctors, most people do recognize that it takes more than just technical skills to make the professional a good one. People routinely judge a doctor to a great extent on his attitude. This is not because people don't understand anything in medicine beyond bedside manner. Obviously, they know it doesn't really matter if the doctor is unpleasant to be with, as long as he otherwise gives the best possible treatment. The reason people pay attention to a doctor's attitude is that it indicates how much he cares. That is, how concerned he will be that his diagnosis is correct, and how meticulous he will be in treatment. People may worry, quite justifiably, that a doctor may care more about the outcome when treating a rich or influential person than when treating them. People have learned from their own experience and from the horror stories of others that they can judge a doctor even though they have not gone to medical school themselves. They know that there are many ways in which the doctor reveals how much he cares. Does he take time to listen, or does he act rushed? Does he explain what he knows, solicit and answer questions, discuss his reasoning, and present various courses of action and their advantages and disadvantages? Or does he only present his conclusions, or just a prescription? Is he authoritarian, condescending? People recognize that the quality of a doctor's professional work is a function of attitude, not just technical skill. Doctors who treat patients like machines, focusing on their malfunctioning parts in isolation from one another, patching them up, and sending them out the door and back to work, are not that different from the notorious company doctors in their attitudes and values. They function harmoniously within a system that measures human ailment and injury in terms of man hours lost to production. Such doctors do not help workers identify and fight the social causes of their illnesses. They assign responsibility for illness narrowly to the physical agents that are involved, such as germs, without even mentioning the social causes, such as stressful working conditions, pollution, and unfair wages. The overall outlook of these doctors, as expressed through their work, has more in common with the outlook of employers than with that of workers. The competency of a doctor in his professional work, then, as seen from a working-class point of view, involves questions of attitudes, values, and outlook. In short, political questions. Politically, most doctors present textbook cases of the conservative pathology. They are arrogant towards those below them in the social hierarchy and submissive to those above. They know their place and expect you to know yours. Thus, the typical doctor works year after year with a narrow focus on patching people up, content never to take a stand against the social inequities that generate so much stress and disease. Such service work is necessary, of course, but that work, whether prescribing antibiotics or tranquilizers or operating on people's wrists to relieve carpal tunnel syndrome, is part of the status quo, not a contribution to social progress. Tilting in the conservative direction along with the doctors are the medical students, who typically show a version of the doctor's conservatism that is socially acceptable among youth. Where does this tilt come from? No apparent political test is used in selecting people to enter medical school. Rather, individuals are selected as most qualified. Nevertheless, the results, which are consistent year after year, demonstrate that the qualification system is not politically neutral, if not in its design, then certainly in its effect. The final result is doctors who are oriented toward the establishment rather than toward the underrepresented majority. So from that majority's point of view, the standard criteria now being used to determine professional qualification in medicine do not help produce doctors who will best serve society. The standard criteria do not pass the test of our second question. What about the special criteria? The norms that medical schools use to select students for the positions set aside under affirmative action programs. Do these criteria fare better on our second question? If special admissions result in doctors who are even slightly less conservative, but otherwise equal, then the underrepresented majority does benefit when the standard criteria for admissions are suspended, as was done for the 16 positions at UC Davis. Because of their experiences as victims of discrimination, minorities as a group are clearly to the left of center on the American political spectrum and, on the average, are less conservative as doctors. Thus, as far as our second question is concerned, To the extent that special admission criteria play a role in producing the less conservative doctors, special criteria are indeed better than standard criteria. It is crucial to note that the underrepresented majority is not necessarily better served merely by selecting working-class minority or women students instead of middle-class white males. It is possible to do that in a way that produces doctors who are no more oriented toward the underrepresented majority than are the traditional lot. In fact, when the standard criteria do admit members of the underrepresented majority, they do so in just that way. For example, students from lower-class families who are selected for admission by the same criteria as others do not make less conservative doctors. In the words of Columbia University medical sociologist John L. Colombatos, "The socioeconomic background of physicians has little effect on their political attitudes. The reason for this is not that physicians from lower class backgrounds have become less liberal than they were before they entered medicine, but that they were no more liberal than physicians from upper class backgrounds to begin with." Colombatos told me that apparently there is a differential selection somewhere along the way. What all this means is that the standard criteria at their best, that is, when equal opportunity is enforced, select more carefully for political orientation than for socioeconomic background. The result is that professionals with working-class backgrounds are no more likely than others to maintain a working-class orientation in their work. Affirmative action, on the other hand, does benefit workers, minorities, and women because it admits them on a different basis through a relaxed version of the standard criteria, leading to graduates who are more likely to be oriented toward the underrepresented majority through their work.
I've been reading from Chapter 7 of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. Jeff Schmidt has a Ph.D. in physics from the University of California and was a writer and editor for Physics Today for 19 years. He was fired from his job after publishing this book. The international physics community and hundreds of others are demanding that Jeff get his job back. You can help by signing on to one of the open letters at his website, disciplinedminds.com.
We've all seen the movies about gangsters and thugs, about cunning mob bosses and the lords of the drugs. But listen now closely if you've got the time. Cause I'd like to tell you about organized crime. All the old mafiosos and cinema crooks, they may sport the pinstripes and sinister looks, but you'll have to look elsewhere if you'd like to find the real perpetrators of organized crime. Try Irving DaCosta or MBNA, Home Depot, Staples, or Ruby Tuesday, or the corner store owner who treats you like slime. All wanted as suspects in organized crime. Well, raise up your hand now if you got a job, making shit wages working until your head throbs. They're making a profit from robbing you blind. They say it's just business, it's organized crime. And the more the rich got, then the more the rich get, while everyone else lives on toil and sweat. The boss makes $10, you just make $8. It's not fair compensation, it's organized crime. And the tide of prosperity lifts every boat, they say, as we fall down and drown in their moat. It's a game of roulette that you'll lose every time. This economy's nothing but organized crime. And if it weren't cruel enough, then the government comes, giving handouts to rich folk and sacks in our crumbs. We pay them to shaft us, then give us the line. How it's all in our interest, this organized